That's the record, and then I have my backup recording here on the my little Rev.
Okay.
So good. So I like to just open sacred space and share a little bit of sacred time together. This is Amy Weintraub. We welcome her for this interview for Yoga Radicals, and today is April the 23rd. So just letting this shared space through these new ways of connecting, Amy, just find us. And knowing that your invitation and invocation now here in your embodied practice may offer, will offer future yogis some inspiration from these deeper practices that you and many others have brought to life. And so just sensing in to this moment together and adding any other words that you'd like to have here at the beginning before I launch into the questions.
Just, I was taking a Tara Bodhi mudra, so I will resume that and just asking that the wisdom, the grace, the clarity, the compassion, the love of all our teachers flow through us, knowing that we have all that we need to support each other in this process together of exploring the depths of transformation through yoga. Namaste. Jai Bhagwan.
On, right, Jai Bhagwan. So the first question, Amy, the invitation is to settle in to the particular frame of reference that you'd like to use through the course of the questions. And the beginning is about this initiation and invocation that is part of this generative practice of leadership that I'm using to frame the questions. So how did your inspiration arise? What did you think, feel, and sense? And where did it come from? This is, of course, relative to your project.
I think that pain and suffering were the doorway, the portal into the exploration of yoga as a healing modality, not only for myself, but for those I served. So it was the rocky start that I had in life. And when I look at the visionaries who I think of, like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, I just happened to have been looking towards them today, as a matter of fact, because I subscribe to Richard Rohr's newsletter. And, you know, it is that that dark night or that dark period of time that we can make a choice from. And from that place, I discovered yoga and made the choice that this was going to be the path for me. And so I would say the framework is deep pain that for me became suffering, and then the release of suffering through practice, and then the ability developing always in myself and others in riding the waves of pain so that they don't become suffering. again.
Thank you. And so as that spark or that initiatory awareness began to take form in the actions that you generated from that choice-making process, how did you know that something more was potentially actionable from your own personal practice? How did it scale up so that it could become that service toward others?
I think that as I began to feel better and better, I wanted to learn what it was that was affecting me so deeply that I went from a place of deep emptiness, and not in the Buddhist sense of emptiness, but empty, to a sense of fullness. What had made me the difference? And I knew at that point that I had begun practicing asana, pranayama, and a little bit of meditation. I had too much agitated mind to really focus and meditate at that point. That so I decided, I became passionate about understanding that. So I became a Kripalu yoga teacher. And for me, it was about deepening my own practice that I did the month-long teacher training at Kripalu many years ago, January 91. And if at that point, I didn't think I was going to teach, but after I finished the program, I was passionate to share with others what had transformed my life. So I began first to teach in my community, and then I was fortunate enough that Rudy Pierce invited me to be one of the first outside teachers from the ashram, which was at the time, to come in and you know, serve as a yoga teacher for a week or two so people could have time off. So I began this process of daily practice, and then I began to, I wrote an article for Yoga Journal about my own healing and did a lot of research. It was called Yoga, the Natural Prozac. And it was the cover article in 1999, I believe, November. I think that's when it was. And from that place, I felt like, having done the research and having spoken to so many folks who had healed, that it was now time to begin to move out with that. And so Yoga for Depression came out of that, the book, and then I had been teaching at Kripalu, and I was asked, would I put together a training? And so the first, the book came out in 2004. And shortly after that, I was asked to develop a training, and I did. And that training evolved into the Life Force Yoga Practitioner Training, which is now much, more robust, and, manualized, and for yoga teachers and yoga therapists and mental health professionals and other health professionals. So it was a kind of organic, it wasn't a plan, like, okay, I've never actually, I know you're a coach and this is not the way you operate, I've never had goals or a five-year plan or anything like that. It just kind of was an evolution from my passion to share what had transformed my life and to understand why it had transformed my life. So I actually began to collaborate with researchers like Satbir and Singh Khalsa, and also others, Lisa Eulebecker at Brown and at Butler Hospital, and others, to sort of document the changes and do research for others so that we could see what it was that was making such a difference. And I was fortunate enough just recently to collaborate with Holger Kramer, who's a researcher in Germany who's done tremendous work in the field and has done survey literature of what it is, what's the aspects of yoga that are the most healing. And of course, you know, when you get down to that little gem, that little crystallized part, it's the breath. It's the breath. And so pranayama, kriya practices are core to what I practice, what I teach. And that includes mantra, because to help people breathe more deeply and extend that exhalation, which stimulates the parasympathetic, that mantra. So I'm going way beyond the scope of your question. So,
no, it's perfect, Amy. These models are based upon complexity theory. So as we learn to unpack from our own lived experience, right, that's the nature of what I hear you actually expressing, is that you've teased apart, you've been articulate in each and every moment of what helped, and then you did more of it. And then what I'm hearing from the way that we imagine how presencing and then co-presencing works from the inside out, a lot of this is coming into the yoga research now, that you had this natural, and I'll just move into the next question, ability to actually create what we're calling co-initiatory fields, those others that begin to get interested in what's coming through you, mm-hmm. right? And that I'm not sure what yet we'll find would be how you would invite that reflection of others, of you at that time in early time, just around the book, the first book, and when you were asked. Yeah. So can we just do a stopgap and zoom back in time and go into a reflection, knowing that you were experimenting and exploring very iteratively, right? And that's part of this model. We try again, we do other things. What did they see or sense in you? Can you offer the readers a taste of that?
Well, okay. I would say that there were three responses. The first, the most motivating, and for which I'm very grateful, were people reaching out to say, thank you. This book changed my life. And it wasn't the book, it was the inspiration in the book that brought people to the yoga mat. I had an experience at Kripalu when I was teaching. At the end of the Sunday, in the food line, I was next to a man who said to me, hi, how are you? What are you doing here? And I said, I was teaching a program on yoga for depression. And he said, are you Amy Weintraub? Did you write that book, Yoga for Depression? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, my daughter just graduated from yoga teacher training. That's why I'm here. I'm here for her graduation. And when she came out of the hospital, having suffered depression, I gave her your book. And this was 2 years later, she started practicing yoga. It changed her life. And she's now a Kripalu yoga teacher. That woman actually came to eventually another couple of years later, she was in the Life Force Yoga Practitioner Training at Kripalu. Mm-hmm. It had changed her life so much that she wanted to take it out into the world. So those are the kinds of responses of like, just you know, people feeling that they're, that I had given, I consolidated information for them to be able to make sense of why yoga was working, and it inspired them to go practice. So that was the first and most rewarding response. And it was emails and, you know, at when I was teaching, people coming up to me tearfully, thank you, thank you, thank you, that kind of thing. Then from two other places, I got some harder response. One was from people whose lineage meant that they practice what their guru told them to practice. And what I was doing was synthesizing practices, making them accessible so that those folks, even in medical settings, who didn't want to, you know, no, I don't want to practice yoga, would be able to adapt and receive these teachings, which I feel could, were life-changing, transformational. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking trainings I had received, and I had studied with by that point, it wasn't just Prapalu yoga. I'd studied with many masters, and I had integrated some of the practices that were the most healing for me and others. That, for some people, was not okay. And it was, and it would sort of spark a reaction of like, you know, how dare she teach, you know, aspects of this and aspects of that, that she's not in a lineage. And a lineage, you need that lineage background. Well, I had the lineage of Prapalu, but in some people's mind, that wasn't a real lineage. So it was, there was that. And then there were the occasional, I won't say this was frequent, from the mental health professional standpoint, many, I should say this first, mental health professionals came to work with, train with me and become Life Force Yoga practitioners. Had that sense of respect for the union of both mental health and yoga. And in fact, I just, as an aside, I lived with a psychologist for 16 years. I studied, I'm an autodidact in the area of psychology. That is not, it's not my, I have training in certain aspects of psychology, internal family systems training and other, but I am not a licensed mental health professional. But had always, as a press fiction writer, had that impulse to understand the psychological antecedents of why we do what we do and why we feel what we feel. So it has always been a passion of mine. And I read, you know, Kohut and many, many of the, a lot of literature on psychological, both well-being and disturbances. So, but there were people within the mental health community who, some of whom were practicing yoga, but had not sort of consolidated it, who would say to me, well, what's your degree? What gives you the right to teach yoga for depression? I mean, what's your background? And, you know, putting me on the defensive a lot. And that would happen. And there were even, I won't even go into it. But anyways, suffice it to say, that doesn't happen so much anymore. I don't know. I guess over the years, maybe I'm just not hearing it, but over the years, it's like Amy's out there. She's doing this work. There are a lot of psychotherapists who are also doing the work of Life Force Yoga and finding it supportive of their clients and helpful in their practice, and also giving them new inspiration and new energy in their clinical practices, because they're practicing some of these tools of yoga that are appropriate in clinical settings. And not only are they helping their clients manage their mood, but they're making them, as the therapist, feel better.
Right, right. Thank you. That's beautifully articulated around this phase in this emerging leadership development model that I'm framing this all from, around the personal qualities of your leadership. So I just want to back up again and put a mirror up around how your personal commitment to your own healing process, as well as your autodidactic way of using your self-referential capacity to build something that others could actually also use. That's what innovation is, Amy, that synthesizing that you were talking about, the pulling and the witnessing that it worked. And then you had this generative, authentic wish to share it, because that's part of, I would say, a core character trait of yours. And you also got these different positions, feedback, the positive, the negative, the neutral. So if those in this model become the places and spaces where the cultivation, the further cultivation of life force yoga practices, the use of mantra, the way in which the blending, the quite unique blending of what life force yoga based practices really offer people, what were some of the places that you could point to now, more from a yogic perspective, that supported your further development? Some people have been naming a sutra or a particular set of teachings. I'd like to know a little bit more, particularly for the readers, why mantra maybe for you in the development of your practice, but something that would be more from the scripture and from the teachings that, that you could say helped you.
Okay. Well, first of all, I had an experience in India long before all of this. This was would have been in the early 90s, in which I had a teacher from the Advaita Vedanta tradition. And it's... I get teary just thinking about it, because there was a falling in love with the teachings and with the guru. And the Advaita Vedanta, I could put it, this is not a sutra, although I could probably find one if it give me some time, I could look. But I remember Sandhya Lahari studying that. I'd have to look. I haven't looked at it in years. But also, it's a great it's a great poem of non-dualism, essentially, Advaita Vedanta. And there was just the stories, little fish out there, you know, looking for the great ocean, you know, looking for God, little fish. And then it's just open your mouth. It's all around you. It's within you. You know, that kind of, it's like the universe is God, and the universe is and there's no separation, essentially, that non-dual sense of Atman and Brahman as one. And there was that, and I went back the next year. That's a whole other story. But in relation to your question of mantra, at all of the different yoga centers and ashrams, because mostly it was ashrams at the time in the late 80s and the early 90s, both in the US and in India, there was always, and is, when I think about places like Shivananda in the Bahamas, chanting. And I would find a how much it filled me to chant, to use sound. And so I found that chanting could really lift my spirit. And to make it accessible, then, you know, jumping 20 years later, 30 years later, to make it accessible to use the Bija mantras rather than chanting to Krishna and Radha or Sita Ram, but to use the Bija mantras, to use universal mantras like Atma Hridaye, the heart mantra, that don't invoke deities, makes it much more acceptable and accessible for everyone. So, but for me, going to just chanting evokes a place that, or it brings me to a place that meditation brings me to. Not always, but both meditation and chanting have the potential to clear the space, to remove the obstructions, so that I reconnect with my own true nature, with deep, you know, that sense of Atman and Brahman as one, as not separate, and feeling apart and connected, deeply and intimately connected.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you. So as you learned from your own heart and mind intelligence coming into one with all that is Brahman, Atman, I know from your curiosity that you like to create an awareness of how that worked biopsychophysiologically, mm-hmm. from the science. So using the science right next to your own personal experience, can you say a little bit about that unique quality of your teaching, your lived experience, which you so beautifully talked about, but now as the science got clearer, you made such a beautiful offer of marrying that in the Life Force Yoga protocols, for instance, and in the trainings that I had the benefit of attending and helping teach.
Well, I guess it was my own curiosity and passion to find out what it was that was making a difference. So I was a sort of a little bit of a nerd for a while. Now I'm just practicing. I'm not as tuned into the research. But for a while, I would do at least a monthly newsletter. And I would just stay on top of all the research that was coming out. When I wrote the book Yoga for Depression, there wasn't that much. I was going back to, there was Shirley Tellis and her really important work in the early 90s on left and right nostril breathing. And then there was some work from the 70s from France. And as I think, Yoga for Depression was published, and then more and more research it seemed like, I mean, I collaborated with some of the researchers, but there was also a great flowering of research in this millennium, a great flowering of research. And I just stayed on top of it because it was like, it would be so exciting to me to say, wow, this validates my felt experience. This study here on sound done in 2011 by the National Institutes of Mental Health and Neuroscience in India looked at Om and found that it actually stimulated vagal nerve activity and parasympathetic. You know, I would get so excited about what I was reading and, again, wanting to share it. So I had a newsletter that went out at least once a month that was research-based. And it was just my excitement of like, yes, what we're doing works. It works. And here's why, here's how. And then that, of course, got integrated into the training. And, I have to say, and this is probably off the record, but I'll see a study come through. I'll go and I'll look at the abstract. If I'm interested, I'll read it. But it's not like I have to know why anymore. It's just doing
right.
it.
Yeah. Right. So let's open the lens again, Amy, because this breathing in and breathing out model of awareness building, let's just name it very generally, that you, as I'll say, the alchemy of your own personal development process through the practice of yoga, and then the way in which your professional identity began to flourish and blossom, those pathways, as I listen to you, weave a very interesting story of service, not only to that true nature in yourself, but the potential true nature in others. You mm-hmm. spoke about it. And so I'd love to invite you, if you feel so moved, to speak into the future about this same discovery process mm-hmm. that others will likely entertain as well in their lifespan, as you have so explicitly mapped out in your lifespan. And as we look into the future together, knowing that readers who will listen to your, read your words, they might still be lost themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you were to collapse into a few sentences, what was that continuing inspiration to continue to go forward? And is there a memory, a dream, a reflection of some sort that really solidified your motivation to continue?
I can think of stories in working with people. I thought at first the direction of your question, I thought was about, you know, sort of seeing, well, okay, I could, lots and lots of things are coming through my mind right now.
Good.
I remember when I started a program at the Juvenile Detention Center here in Tucson, and I had been at that time, it was before I wrote Yoga for Depression, or around the same time I was writing it. At that time, I had been teaching 7 classes a week and in Tucson. And I really wanted to serve because the people I was teaching were middle class, mostly white folk, who would thank me and they loved the yoga and they said it made a difference in their lives, etc. But I felt like I needed to reach more than that. So I started a program. I had to push my way into the Juvenile Detention Center. And lots of side stories there about that. But my first time teaching these girls who had these labels on them of bad, you know, totally not good enough, but more than worse than not good enough, bad, was the connection I felt with them immediately was so inspiring to me. They came in, they were over-medicated, they were on a lot of carbs, they'd shuffle in. And after the yoga class, there was such a transformation in their faces. And they would say, look at this is my daughter, Missy, she's with my grandma, you know, that kind of thing. And they'd want to share with me. And I walked out into the parking lot and just tears rolled down my face that this yoga could be so, it was a simple practice. They were doing full belly yoga. They had just eaten lunch, and that's when I was assigned the time to see them. Had so affected them and me. It was such an inspirational moment of, I need to bring this out. This is so important for the world. Another situation that is also a client when I was doing individual yoga therapy, she was working for Gabby Giffords and was at the site when the gunman in, I think it was 2011, killed six people, I believe it is, wounded nine, including Gabby Giffords. My client survived and came to me after having gone to therapy about a year later. She was in panic mode. Her brother had just died of some kind of brain unexpected embolism that killed him. And she was re-triggered and she was out of control. And so she came and we did yoga therapy for 8 sessions. It was actually paid for by the Victims Fund, Pima County Victims Fund. And she felt so transformed by her experience. And my experience in working with her was so transformative for me. And that incident, that work together, made such a difference in her life that she became first a yoga teacher and then a life force yoga practitioner. So it was like when people feel that this work has healed them and reached them and touched them, they want to help others with it. They want to reach out. That's how I felt. And that's how people who have come to, you know, read the book, become yoga teachers, and then come to the Life Force Yoga trainings. That's, you know, sort of the evolution of it. And you framed it in the beginning, this question of like finding new true nature. And that's the work for me, for Life Force Yoga practitioners like you and others. It's not about fixing or changing or having any agenda about what positive mental health is supposed to look like in the person or people you're working with. It is helping them clear their space, letting go of story, letting go of the vrittis, letting go of all that so that their own true nature arises and they connect with that true nature. So it's not about like, here's the formula, here's the RX, here's the prescribed practice. It's co-creating, you know, working with someone and then finding towards the end of that session, what is it that you felt most that you loved? What did you love about the practice? What did you find most enjoyable for you? See, I'm not talking about healing or anything like that. And then co-creating some kind of home practice with them. So it's not like, here's the prescription, but let's co-create together what worked and you know, then writing it down. So it's okay. All about co-creation. And when I teach practitioners, it's also about learn the practices and then make them your own. Make mm-hmm. it work for you and for your clients. You know your clients. They know themselves better than you do, and you know them. Yeah.
Thank you so much. So remember from the beginning, I was mentioning that this whole practice and process is about lifting up the narrative of moving from a me consciousness to a we consciousness. And what you just spoke into, Amy, is that self-awareness that shifts in the relational field from a me to a we. Mm-hmm. And I just want to appreciate the way in which you landed in the very explicit awareness, which is what I look at in this larger world of how might we actually look at the relational field as mm-hmm. the field where the information arises from. It's what's in between that once we get stable enough in our self-identity or however you want to call it, regardless of where we came from or what our training or our lineages were, that it is that collective field of awareness that we're trying to nurture and cultivate. So thank you for finding a way into the question from your own experience. And so this is part of this ending phase now in the questions, that from this place of emergence of the new, right, that is that liminal space. It's the place before the new moon, it's all these wonderful transitional spaces. And now that we're in this corona gifting time, I'm wondering if you could apply it and add some learnings from this time of self-sheltering as it relates to your practice history and your professional teaching history. What's new from this last several months, for instance, that might add a little kernel of wisdom here, or not?
Given this time, I've been called upon, and with cancellation of all my work in the world outside, I, of course, have been called upon to do more online. I'm a technophobe, basically. And that's been I'm crawling up the learning curve for all of that. And I feel, in some ways, there has been, I have to say that I feel that there's no eye contact here with you and I have. You're looking at your camera, or you're looking at the up there, and then you're not looking at me, or I'm looking at you and you're not seeing my eyes. And so I'm feeling that the core teachings, the true teachings, don't come through the camera. We can be inspired. Mm-hmm. We can practice, and we can, but if relationship is the real healing element, and right now I'm looking at my camera, and I'm not looking at you. So there's a disconnect right there. So if relationship is the true healing element, we have a barrier here. And I don't feel that this is the best modality for the teachings of yoga and meditation and the true teachings, because the true teachings require relationship. Whether it's, you know, the old model of guru disciple, or just the love in the room. It's much harder. It's, you know, I can watch something inspiring, and I have in this last few weeks, and I can chant with Krishna Das or my local friends, you know, I can do all of that, and I can feel uplifted to a certain extent, but there's nothing like feeling community around you, and social distancing has limited that. So I guess I am just looking forward to the time when we can gather again as a community in person, because this time has its elements of disconnect, even as we reach across the world to connect with each other.
Yeah.
Good lessons. I mean, personally, it's the, you know, learning Zoom, you know, that's about it. And, you know, learning that my camera I had to record a bunch of stuff, pre-record for a training I'm offering at Inner Peace. And I mostly used Zoom, and I realized that my laptop camera is nothing compared to my phone. And I should have done a lot of it on my phone. It's much higher quality than, I don't know whether it's my laptop or Zoom, but I mean, you look great right now. And I look good when I look at myself. I look fine. I mean, not talking about my hair, but you know, the quality of the image. But when I play back a recording, it's not as good as camera. Have you found that? Just aside, sorry to hijack
the interview. I had to do a reading last night, and I looked at the film afterwards, and it was very hard not to be very self-judgmental.
Yeah, you did it on Zoom?
Doesn't represent. It was actually on the Google Meet.
Oh.
Not a Google person, but it's the same camera. It comes out the same, you know.
Right.
But thank you for that, Amy, because as we move into this new time that we're still co-discovering, those of us who have had transmissions, and thank you for talking about your experience in India, but also the transmission from your own nervous system as it related to the universal life force, which is the carrying of that personal transformation into your unique offer, that transmutation that you've done over the years and that others continue to do. Mm-hmm. And so if we're now in a world of distilling that you so beautifully did in your offer, and we have these constraints of the camera and these Zoom things, mm-hmm. where, this is a question about the future again, as you enter that reality of accepting that it's different now, just like aging, right? It's different now. I can't do what I used to do, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. What's a small window into hope, even as the grief gets larger? What's a small window into hope, even as the grief of our ecosystem collapse, for instance, that the young ones are going to be dealing with more than we have?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to tilt my camera. I'm sitting on a cushion. I'm still in my pajama bottoms. but I'm on my yoga mat.
Yep.
And it's about, I mean, this is not where my yoga mat usually is. It is for when I do Zoom calls because it's dark in the corner where I practice. But I think we need to go within and find the practices that we may already have, hopefully. If we're brand new to this yoga thing, it's going to be a little harder, I think. But to, you know, find the teacher out there on the that we resonate with. I mean, there are lots and lots of offerings now. Free, some of them for very little money. Find the yoga teacher that inspires you. And if you're new to practice in these times, so find it and just keep going back. Keep going back. Do your practice every day. Find a space in your apartment, your home, that is that you can go to. Maybe if you have children, it's after the kids are in bed or before they wake up. Maybe you even start in bed with something that you're listening to, iPod, that's old phone, what you've got downloaded on your phone, so that you're, you know, you give yourself that window of practice every day to clear your space, and then you can receive what the universe brings. So for those of us who already have a practice, it's much easier. But for those who are brand new to this, I would say just look online until you find, oh, I really love her voice, or I really love his style of practice. It makes me feel good. So find that inspiration online and then just keep going back.
Great, great. Thank you. I love watching your arms reach out as you kind of invoke that possibility for others, Amy. That's so representative of your beautiful heart. So, it's been wonderful listening to you answer some of these questions. And just this last minute or two, let's just be quiet for a moment and relax again in our sacred spaces, each of us in our spots here. Sun is shining. And this wrapping around of the heart's wisdom that I know you've done so well in your life, and I have learned so much from you and your wisdom, your personal courage. It's something that's unique in the yoga world. And if there's any other small set of words or offer for the end of our time, just let's see if that wants to come forward.
Well, what's arising is my own personal mantra, which arises, and then just being, our practices are there to give us compassion for ourselves, to bring a sense of connection to ourselves, to that which is divine within us, and to each other. And that's both the one-on-one and the bigger we. So finding a way every day to evoke that compassion for self, karuna, that compassion for self that then expands into the we, into the universe, for this planet of ours. And for me, yoga, chanting, then I include in that chanting, pranayama, meditation, that's all of yoga, is that portal into compassion.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Be well. Be well.
You too. Stay well. Yeah. And blessings on your poetry book. I have to go order it. Yeah.
Yes, it's a nice compilation of a spiritual journey during my healing process. So yeah, it's a nice thing. I'll be sending out order information soon.
Beautiful. Congratulations.
Have fun with Connie. I hope you're all doing okay out there.
Yeah, we are. And she's getting ready with our bikes. We're going to go for our A Mountain bike ride.
I'm lucky. Go for it.
Love you.
Love you.
Take care.
Thank you so much.